Friday, May the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, people trying to cope with a missing Egypt Air passenger plane.
General consternation, fairly somber mood in Egypt in general over the crash.
Also ahead, we'll learn about the so-called Ivory Queen.
A wily criminal accused of illegally gathering and moving some $2.5 billion worth of elephant tusks to China and other parts of East Asia.
Plus, Ai Weiwei on the migrant situation and something new from an old musical friend. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Search teams in the Mediterranean are looking for that Egypt Air jet believed to have crashed into the sea as it approached Cairo on a flight from Paris. Early reports that the plane's wreckage had been located near a Greek island were incorrect. The Airbus jet with 66 people on board disappeared from radar early Thursday. We begin our reporting in Paris with Lisa Bryant.
Les informations que nous avons pu recueillir, le Premier ministre, les membres du gouvernement, et bien sûr...
Speaking on national TV, French President François Hollande confirmed the plane had been damaged and lost. He said no hypothesis has been ruled out, whether this was an accident or a terrorist attack. He said the French government is in contact with Egyptian and Greek authorities to help in the search mission. Egypt Air said it lost contact with the Airbus A320 at about 2:30 a.m. Cairo time when the airliner was at an altitude of nearly 11,300 meters and just 16 kilometers inside Egyptian airspace. Greece's defense minister said the flight made abrupt turns and suddenly lost altitude before vanishing from radar. If the investigation points to a possible terrorist attack, questions will likely point to Charles de Gaulle Airport security, which has been considered good and was boosted after the attacks in Paris and Brussels. Some Charles de Gaulle's staff have been on a partial strike this week. Last year, dozens of airport staff had their passes withdrawn over fears of radicalization. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And now we go to reporter Edward Uranian in Cairo. My colleague Susan Yaki asked him how the families of the Egyptian passengers on board that Egypt Air flight were reacting to all of this.
Some of the passengers were interviewed by Egyptian journalists on their way to the terminal building where Egypt Air and hospital officials were due to meet them. Several of the older women were crying, and one of the men was very angry and snapped at the journalists. General consternation, fairly somber mood in Egypt in general over the crash.
Is anything being done for the families? Are they being given any special attention?
Well, certainly they've been kept away from journalists, other than those who are walking into the building and not under the control of the Egypt Air officials. They have reportedly been receiving psychiatric counseling. Clearly, that's one of the practices after a plane crash. Other than that, it's not clear whether the government is going to give them compensation. That sometimes happens during acts of terror or mishaps, rail mishaps. So we still have to wait on that detail.
And speaking of the government, they have been quick to come out and make remarks about this incident.
Well, I think what the retired Egyptian officials have been trying to say in private is that they're worried that another air mishap is likely to further impact the tourism sector, which has already been negatively impacted by a crash, the crash of the Russian passenger jet over the Sinai last October, and of the hijacking of an Egypt Air domestic flight to Cyprus last March, in addition to two separate attacks on tourists in Luxor and Hurghada, which are major tourist destinations in addition to Sharm el-Sheikh.
Could you tell us a little bit about the tourist industry there and how it's been affected by these incidents?
Up until now, the Egyptian tourism ministry has been fighting back to try to get tourists from other countries, Arab countries, when tourism has been negatively affected from Europe, from Britain, from Russia. Russia has canceled flights to the Sinai, so has Britain. That hasn't affected Cairo Airport so far. tourists are still coming to Cairo, still going to other areas like Luxor and Hurghada, as I mentioned earlier. The hotels here in Cairo seem to have a large turnout of Arab tourists, so I don't know in terms of the actual numbers how badly the economic performance is being affected, but certainly Egyptian tourism officials have been trying to fill the gap with Arab tourists.
That is Edward Uranian in Cairo. He was speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Now a look at what's being said online about the situation with the missing Egyptair jet. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, joins us for the latest. Hi, G. We know the story is still developing. Where might people go to keep posted about the news?
Hi, Steve. I'd recommend going straight to the source by looking up Egypt Air on Facebook and Twitter. On Facebook, it's posting official press releases, and the latest one shows that many of the top comments are from the Egyptian people. One of them wrote, he wishes news outlets wouldn't blame the country's planes and airport because the fault lies with terrorists.
You know, gee, we just heard from Edward Uranian that the Egyptians are really concerned about how this particular incident will affect their tourism in light of all the other incidents that he's mentioned that have happened in recent times. I know they're concerned about their national image. What's being said on Twitter?
It's also on there, at Egypt Air. It's tweeting both in English and Arabic, and the latest one in English reads like this. The Egyptian investigation team, in cooperation with a Greek counterpart, are still searching for other remains of the missing plane.
I got you. I understand. Any journalists following the story?
Christian Amanpour, who is the chief international correspondent with CNN, has been quite prolific on Thursday, and one of her latest tweets shows the vice president of Egypt Air told the network that the wreckage has not been found and that they stand corrected.
Yeah, and of course there must have been some sort of reaction from officials here in the U.S.
Steve, out of the three presidential contenders, Donald Trump was the only one who tweeted about it. The presumptive GOP nominee wrote, looks like yet another terrorist attack. Airplane departed from Paris. When will we get tough, smart, and vigilant? Great hate and sickness. Now, that tweet received more than twice the number of retweets he usually gets. It was shared almost 10,000 times and liked by nearly 24,000 people so far. From Washington, the State Department was the first to tweet about it, sharing a video of Secretary of State John Kerry expressing his condolences. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. That's our own social media expert, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Still ahead on the program, Egypt conducting some operations against the Islamic State in Sinai. Among the many stories we're following here on The Voice of America, in Nigeria, rescue of another young girl kidnapped by Boko Haram. NATO alliance say they're getting stronger against the Islamic State militants. Plus China demanding the U.S. stop air surveillance over its coast. We have expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. general says that Egypt's military is carrying out operations against Islamic State fighters in the Sinai Peninsula. Our correspondent at the Pentagon, Carla Babb, has more from Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base. That's in the U.S. state of Georgia. The latest stop as she travels with U.S. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joe Dunford.
As many Egyptians grieve the loss of life from a crashed Egypt airplane that Egypt's government says is likely due to terrorism, Egypt's military is taking the fight to Islamic State militants in the Sinai Peninsula. General Joe Dunford updated reporters traveling with him across the Atlantic Thursday.
I understand, and I don't have any details right now, that there's actually operations against them ongoing right now by the Egyptians. So we'll be looking forward to hearing the results of operations that are ongoing.
Dunford did not provide further details on the mission. The U.S. estimates there are up to about 1,000 Islamic State fighters in the Sinai. Dunford said the militants are getting a boost from a sizable Bedouin insurgency that is cooperating with them. While the Sinai is an isolated territory, flanked by Egypt's military on one side and Israel's military on the other, Islamic State fighters there are reaching out across the Middle East.
We have seen a connection between the Islamic State and the Sinai in Raqqa. We have seen, you know, communication between the Islamic State and the Sinai and the Islamic State in Libya and elsewhere. So we're watching that pretty closely.
Navy Captain Greg Hicks, a spokesman for General Dunford, said the Egyptian operations against IS in the Sinai are not related to the downed Egyptian plane. Islamic State militants in the Sinai claimed responsibility for a Russian passenger plane that crashed last year after taking off from an Egyptian Red Sea resort, killing everyone on board. Carla Babb, VOA News, Kings Bay, Georgia.
And for more on this story and the rest of the news, you can check out our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Afghan government has signed a draft agreement with the militant group Hezbollah Islami and still needs the backing of the group's veteran leader and warfighter, as well as the U.S.-designated terrorist Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. The group has been linked to al-Qaeda and is suspected of widespread rights abuses. Thomas Rudig is co-director of the Kabul-based Afghanistan Analyst Network, described here to VOA's Victor Beatty, details of this tentative agreement.
Hezbollah Islami promises to finish all military activity against the Afghan government and practically come back into the political fray here on the Afghan side. And in return, the Afghan government drops all accusations about political and military crimes in the past, will take initiatives to de-blacklist the party and its leader from the UN blacklist, and give a couple of privileges like accommodation, honorary title, and so on to the leader when he returns to Afghanistan.
Is there any sign that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar will agree to this?
Well, I mean, the negotiating delegation from Hezb has agreed to that, so I think they will have their instructions also from the side of Hezb leader. But as I said, there are a couple of stumbling blocks around prisoners belonging to Hezb Islami still held in Afghanistan, and also the blacklisting issue. Hezb Islami insists that the blacklisting takes place first, and then it will sign. If and when the Afghan government starts such a procedure, and when, it will probably take weeks, if not months, so that's still in the future, and things can happen on the way. And of course, also Hezbollah Islami has a lot of foes from the old war in Afghanistan who will not be too happy to see the leader come back to Afghanistan.
What are the conditions that prompted Hezbollah Islami to come to the table?
Well, I think Hezbollah Islami has already a lot of people here in the government. That's known. There were different wings. Some are in the government. One is the deputy of the quasi-prime minister. A lot of other people, ministers, governors, and so on. Also, someone from Hezbollah Islami has taken part in the 2014 presidential elections, and they have been pushing for reuniting all these different wings of Hezbollah Islami. And that's also part of that. And Hekmatyar has been the historical leader, so he's the number one. If he returns, everyone else will line up behind him again. That's at least what I expect.
Thomas Ruddick also says that the Hezbollah Islami, once allied with the Taliban, has since dropped its earlier objective of battling against what it called foreign occupation. He says ties between the two are strained while the Taliban maintains its opposition to negotiations with the Afghan government. Tanzania is putting on trial a woman who allegedly sold large quantities of elephant tusks to overseas buyers. VOA's Jeffrey Young reports this action reflects a growing effort by African states to stop the ivory trade and protect the continent's dwindling number of elephants.
She looks like a gentle grandmother, but authorities in Tanzania see Young Finglan quite differently. To them, this 66-year-old Chinese national who has lived in the East African state since the 1970s is the so-called Ivory Queen, a wily criminal accused of illegally gathering and moving some $2.5 billion worth of elephant tusks to China and other parts of East Asia. Tanzania's move against Young Finglan reflects a tough stance the nation has taken in recent years to protect elephants and other wildlife, as African Wildlife Foundation Vice President Philip Maruthi explains.
What we are seeing in Tanzania right now is the right response during a poaching crisis. Tanzania has stringent laws. It has laws that allow jailing up to 35 years, 20 to 35 years, of anyone who is found with an illegal government trophy, including ivory.
Young Finglan was arrested in October 2015 after an investigation that began more than a year earlier. Tanzania says that in 1998, Finglan, who ran a restaurant and a pepper farm, also set up the Beijing Great Wall Investment Company that authorities said facilitated tusk smuggling from 2000 to 2014. Doing that required an extensive criminal syndicate, as noted by James Isiche, director of the International Fund for Animal Welfare East Africa, via Skype.
They are organized. They are groups that are very well networked, that can move literally contraband across borders and over the seas undetected. So it requires a level of sophistication to get that done.
Most sales of ivory were banned by the 1989 Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, called CITES, with exceptions made to allow certain African nations to sell stockpiled tusks to Japan and China in 1999 and again in 2008, when Beijing bought a reported 73 tons of ivory. While the stated intent of these sales was to flood the market to drive down international ivory demand and curb poaching, they triggered the opposite effect. That's described via Skype by the Environmental Investigative Agency's Executive Director, Mary Rice, in London.
The elephant population in Tanzania was decimated by nearly 70% in the space of 6 years in order to supply an illegal demand in Asia.
To get these tusks out of Tanzania and off to China and East Asia, smuggling syndicates often move their contraband through circuitous routes, looking for and taking advantage of corrupt officials, weak inspections, and less stringent laws. That's described via Skype by IFAW's James Isiche.
Ivory or elephants that would have been poached, for instance, in Tanzania, would not necessarily exit through Dar es Salaam, that they would find their way probably to Uganda and then to Kenya and ultimately out from Mombasa.
Stopping the illegal ivory trade takes more than tough laws and vigilance in Africa. Authorities and conservationists say it is equally important to shut off the supply of carved ivory objects, especially in China and other East Asian markets. In recent years, the United States and a number of countries, China included, have held public events where ivory artifacts are rendered worthless by crushing. In conjunction, states such as Kenya have staged tusk burns that destroy ivory's raw material before it has a chance to be carved into trinkets. During Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to Washington in September 2015, he and President Barack Obama issued a statement pledging that both nations would, quote, take significant and timely steps to halt the domestic commercial trade of ivory. At the African Wildlife Foundation, Philip Maruthi underscores the significance of this U.S.-Chinese agreement.
The declaration is historical because it means that the country that consumes more than 80% of the illegal ivory is saying we are moving towards stoppage of consumption. If China, if the consumer countries is stopped, if the demand is stopped today, I can assure you that the killing will stop.
Conservationists say a conviction and strong punishment of Yeng Fenglang in Tanzania can send a strong anti-poaching message to both sides of the illegal ivory trade. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has described the European Union's migrant deal with Turkey as shameful, unlawful, and immoral.
I think it's a very sad situation. Europe have to push those people to Turkey. I think this is a very shameful condition.
That wasn't Ai Weiwei, but Ai Weiwei did go on to say that the situation is sad there and it's going to bring about not anything like a better future. Renowned artist spoke in Athens Thursday as he revealed his artist work produced during his time on the Greek island of Lesbos, where many migrants and refugees have attempted to enter the EU, many times illegally. EU-Turkey deal sees Europe return illegal migrants to camps in Turkey and receive others with verified asylum exchanges. Meantime, Ai Weiwei says the people making the journey to Europe simply have nothing and that they risk their lives for the sake of their children's future. He described Europeans as indifferent to the situation and said that the politicians cannot be trusted to find a solution to the ongoing migrant crisis. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have found evidence of the rare element curium in a carbon-rich meteorite. This radioactive element is not known to occur naturally on Earth, but instead is manufactured or is produced as the side effect of a nuclear explosion. Curium wasn't discovered until 1944, when Glenn Seaborg and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, created the element after bombarding the atoms of plutonium with alpha particles. The researchers who detail their discovery in the journal Science Advances suggest that the curium wound up in the meteorite during the formation of the solar system after a gaseous cloud that went on to create the sun condensed. The researchers say that they believe that finding this rare material in a meteorite may cause scientists to reconsider current models of stellar evolution and nucleosynthesis, which is a change in the chemical composition of a star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It has been 6 years since British singer Corinne Bailey Rae released her last album. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that Rae's new album, The Heart Speaks in Whispers, reflects her new outlook.
Corinne Bailey Rae says she thought about never releasing another album. Her first self-titled album came out 10 years ago and was full of bubbly pop tunes, including the Grammy-nominated Put Your Records On. But then her husband of 7 years, Jason Rae, died of an accidental overdose in the midst of recording her 2010 CD, The Sea. The British singer and musician says she had to do some soul-searching before deciding to go back into the studio.
And really, this record has been a kind of rediscovery for me, sort of myself and my instincts and my dreams and my own body and how it can move and how I feel when I travel and how I feel when I go into a jungle and how I feel when I go swimming in the ocean and all of those things. So I think it's really served as a reminder to me to stay sort of connected and stay true to your own dreams and desires and personality and instinct and memory and all those things.
The 37-year-old singer did find love again. She married her longtime friend and producer Steve Brown in 2013. Corinne says that she also benefited from playing with different musicians, including multiple Grammy winners Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, in between The Sea and her latest release.
And that's had a really big impact on me, I think, just in terms of thinking about freedom. You know, they're both people who are so exceptional what they're doing, have worked so hard as well at what they do that when they get on stage they can just fly, they're just free. And that's Wayne Shorter's whole thing, is like, you know, you don't practice on stage. Once you're on stage, you just kind of completely sort of open yourself up. And I think that's been a big influence on the record, really.
Many of the tunes on The Heart Speaks in Whispers carry a message of hope. Her song, I've Been to the Moon, speaks about vulnerability and opening your heart to someone else.
And I was just kind of singing out these phrases, and I was singing out this song, you know, I've Been to the Moon, and I didn't really know what it meant at first, you know. So I think some of the writing has been hearing these phrases come in and having to kind of, like, unscramble them or find out really what I'm trying to say with that song. So that song just kind of ended up being a metaphor for, you know, when you really put yourself out for someone and you want them to do the same thing for you.
Corinne says she didn't start out to write songs about hope. They just emerged organically as the album progressed. Corinne Bailey-Ray's album, The Heart Speaks in Whispers, is available now. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And one last story for you. Italy's Renaissance capital, Florence, is reclaiming its centuries-old role as an incubator, the interplay between fashion and art. The new director of the Uffizi Gallery has announced plans to transform the costume gallery at the Pitti Palace, where he's also in charge, into a full-fledged fashion museum, while the Ferragamo Foundation this week announced that a citywide exhibit will explore the links between art and fashion. Many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One particularly difficult challenge which societies across the globe have in common is corruption. We are fighting a battle, all of us, for our states, our countries, for our nation state, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the recent Global Anti-Corruption Summit hosted by the UK. Corruption writ large is as much an enemy because it destroys nation states as some of the extremists we're fighting or some of the other challenges that we have faced. Corruption is one of the world's greatest challenges. It is an abuse of power at multiple levels in both the public and private sectors, and it affects all of us. It destroys citizens' trust of their governments, undermines economic development, erodes confidence in democratic institutions, and prepares the way for transnational criminal activities. By crippling basic functions of the state, like security and justice, corruption creates a frustration and vacuum that violent extremists eagerly fill with false promises of a better deal. That helps explain how Daesh took root in Iraq and why the Taliban endures in Afghanistan, wrote Secretary of State Kerry in a blog post just before the summit began. Until we prioritize the fight against corruption, these heinous groups will continue to prey on grievances and recruit new followers who feel disempowered, disrespected, and convinced that the traditional system is rigged against them. It is important to note that it takes a lot of courage to stand up against corruption. That's because of the reality that even if many countries are increasing transparency and tightening banking laws, there will likely be at least one or two nations that may try to attract dirty money by maintaining secrecy in monetary transactions and relaxing their banking laws. So it is up to the rest of the world to ensure there is no safe harbor or impunity for corruption anywhere. It is therefore imperative that the global community, government, civil society, private sector, and the media come together to carry forward the momentum built at the summit and take concrete steps to prevent and fight corruption. Corruption is a poison that erodes trust, robs citizens of their money and their future, and stifles economic growth in the places that need it most, wrote Secretary of State Kerry. It is long past time for the international community to treat corruption with the seriousness and attention it deserves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.